This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In 1996, writer Jan DeBlue's husband slid into a deep depression. She felt helpless, and one way she coped was to walk out of her Outer Banks home and stare up at the dark night sky and those points of light up above. It was an auspicious time to begin stargazing. Within the space of a year, two comets buzzed by the Earth, each visible to the naked eye. And in 1996, Jan DeBlue became a serious student of astronomy. At the same time, of course, she was trying to learn more about her husband's depression. And what she found was that we appear to know more about the heavens and those comets so far away than we do about our minds and what makes the brain tick. Jan DeBlue writes about all of this in her new book, The Year of the Comets, A Journey from Sadness to the Stars, and she's with us now in the studio to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And we welcome your calls this hour, whether about comets, the skies, or about depression. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Well, Jan DeBlue, your book starts off in 1996.
Right.
And it was a year of your life that you say was bookended, bracketed by the appearances of two comets.
Yeah.
And when the first one came, your husband was just starting to show signs of depression.
It was such an emotional time. Jeff's depression was caught up with the death of his mother. His mother had had cancer for several years, and she was really on her last legs. And at the time that I saw the comet, the first comet was Hayakutake, we had gone down to Mississippi because Jeff's sister had called us and said, "Mom's going. You better get down here if you want to say goodbye to her." So it was an incredibly emotional time. And, you know, we were there. We were waiting for her to die. And I woke up one night in the middle of the night and couldn't go back to sleep. And I thought, well, you know, I might as well get up and do something. What can I do? I'll go outside and look. I heard there's a comet that might be out there. So I'll go out and see what the story is.
And so you describe this early in your book that you're down there in Mississippi. We should say most of your stargazing has been near your home in the Outer Banks, Roanoke Island. But here you are in Mississippi. I was wondering if you might read us a passage from
there. Sure. Here's what happened when I walked outside that dark night. A slap of wind made me shiver. I ventured onto the familiar cement porch and down a step into deep darkness. As my eyes adjusted, I could make out the silhouettes of shagbark hickories and loblolly pines. I had been coming here for many years. I knew the open spaces of the yard as thoroughly as I knew the passages within the house, the worn walkways between couch and kitchen, bathroom and bed. Yet this night I moved without any confidence. Mom's impending death was causing my world to tilt in ways I had never thought possible. Even the brick-hard clay of Mississippi seemed like chancy footing. I took a few tentative steps out from the house, looked up, and gasped. The comet stretched halfway across the sky. On this night of no moon, in the deepest rural blackness, its tail reached across continents, across light years, across entire galaxies. It was a river of sparkling debris. Burning dust glinted from its depths, set afire by speed and friction. In places it thinned, and I could see stars winking through. Along its edges, the tail faded unevenly into darkness, thin like smoke, but very still. The head of the comet burned like a great fuzzy star, a white torch tinged with blue, furious and intense.
It's Jan DeBlue reading from her new book, Year of the Comets. And that was the Hayakutake comet, and that was in the spring of 1996. And as we've been saying, this was about the same time your husband started going into depression.
Right.
And we'll talk about that in a moment. But first about the comet. What was so remarkable about this comet?
You know, for starters, just its sheer size. You know, when you see something like that stretched halfway across the sky, it just, you know, it has a tendency to knock your socks off. It certainly knocked mine off. Every other comet, you know, that I had heard about or seen, you know, was a little tiny speck in the sky. I don't know if you remember Halley's Comet back in 1986. It was supposed to be this great show, and it was largely disappointing. So when I stepped out that night expecting to see a comet, you know, I thought I'd see something pretty small. And here was this huge thing. You know, Melinda, it was incredible. For me, it was almost like seeing the face of God. I just stood there looking at it until I was too tired to look anymore. And, you know, having that experience made me really want to learn everything I could about the stars, you know, the realms from which the comets fly, and the universe in general. And it kind of started me off on a quest.
Mm. Indeed. And so you've become a student of astronomy.
Of sorts, yeah. It's a pretty complicated subject.
Yeah, indeed. And this comet is named after, it's Hayakutake.
Hayakutake,
a Japanese name. Is it named after an astronomer? Yeah.
Or? There was an amateur astronomer in Japan who actually moved to an island that was very dark. You know, his name was Yuji Hayakutake. And he moved to the island for stargazing and with the express purpose of finding a comet. And he had already found one comet, and he was out kind of just scanning the skies one night in January 1996. And, you know, he was just kind of looking around, and all of a sudden he saw this huge fireball. And he thought, well, other people must have noticed this, but nobody had. You know, usually when a comet approaches the Earth, we have a lot of warning.
Like how many years warning or how much time?
No, you know, I mean, the Hale-Bopp comet, which appeared, you know, the next spring, they knew about that for almost a year beforehand. And this one, you know, came on really suddenly. We had just a couple of months' notice, and nobody had seen it before. And nobody's likely to see it again for another 26,000 years if we're still around then. So,
so it was one man who was an amateur astronomer.
Right.
Who goes
right.
to this island, not unlike, say, Roanoke Island. I wonder, do you look at the skies and think someday there will be the DeBlue comet up there?
No. This guy's binoculars, just to give you an idea, they were huge. They were like 6 feet big, just the binoculars. So, I mean, you say binoculars, but they were really, you know, a very expensive form of telescope.
Sure. So he was seeing it off at a distance. You were able to see this, though, with the naked eye?
Or? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just one of those incredible evenings where there was amazing clarity. And, you know, Hale-Bopp and Hayakutake were both visible to the naked eye. It's just this particular night, there was, you know, no moisture in the air. The comet was making one of its closest passes to Earth. And it was incredibly beautiful, you know, just everything combined for a wonderful, wonderful sighting.
Yeah. So, and Hale-Bopp happened about a year later, and that was at both ends of your husband's depression, as you write in this book. So you're out there looking at the stars. I wonder, was there some solace to be found up there,
or
was it a way to escape these more earthly, concerns?
You know, I'm a naturalist. I've written for years about nature and landscape and place, and I really love learning everything I can about the way natural systems work. But I'd always been scared, kind of learning about the night sky. It just seemed too hard. You know, all of the concepts that you think of, you know, natural biological concepts here on Earth don't apply, you know, when you start thinking about outer space. You know, at that point, you're dealing with Einstein's relativity and some concepts that I really had just thought were too hard to mess with. And two things happened when I started looking at the night sky. One was that, you know, it did provide a lot of solace. You know, when you're living with somebody who's depressed, the atmosphere in your house tends to be pretty stifling. You know, just, you know, you feel like there's no air. And getting outside and just looking up at the night sky really brought me out of myself. And at the same time, it was this incredible intellectual quest so that I wasn't just focused on my problems nearly as much. You know, I was engaged in a way that I badly needed to be.
So. But you also found, as you write here in the book, that you were also looking into depression as well. And you were pointing out this was 1996, so it wasn't as easy as it might be today to just go online and plug in some words. You had to go to libraries and read rather dry articles about it. But one thing that you pointed out was that you have a quote here that says that somebody has said that our current map of the brain is no more accurate on details than a map of the Earth back in the 1500s.
Isn't that amazing to think about? And at the same time, we're entering what, you know, astronomers are calling an age of precision cosmology. We have incredible probes, you know, space brown probes that are showing us things at the very end of the universe or the edge of time, really. You know, the universe is infinite, but we can look back almost 14 billion years to when the universe began. For some reason, probing the inside of our minds is much more difficult. And, you know, It's because we're all individuals. You know, I have a friend who's a psychologist, and I showed him some of this manuscript. And at one point in the manuscript, I made the statement that, well, you know, look, we know all of this stuff about outer space, and we know virtually nothing about, or, you know, not nothing, but certainly our map of the human brain is much more rudimentary. Why is that? Doesn't this show that there's, you know, the science of the brain is a failure? And my friend, this was a draft of the manuscript, and my friend said, this is really, really unfair, because if you think about outer space and light particles and, you know, you're talking about inanimate matter. There is no life out there. and humans are so complex. What goes on with the, you know, thousands of neurons inside our brain, you know, every minute we're creating thoughts and we're reacting to experiences and we're reacting to brain chemistry. And it's just so much more complex than what goes on even inside a nuclear furnace that makes up a star.
And there are, and much of it is theoretical about what is going on out there. And I would suggest maybe the consequences, I think you made this point, consequences of the theory being flawed are perhaps not as dire.
Right, that's happening
a gazillion miles out there. If we're wrong, okay, so maybe we have to go back to the drawing board and figure out the beginning of things again. Yeah. But if you make a mistake in the theory about what's going on in someone's brain who's suffering from depression,
then it's horrible. You know, you end up with a person who's actually getting sicker based on the treatment that you've prescribed. You know, it's a tremendously difficult task to try to figure out why someone is mentally ill. And it, I mean, mentally ill. You think about that concept, and you know, for years when you'd say mentally ill, I'd think of somebody who was, you know, a sociopath or an axe murderer or something. But indeed, you know, depression, somebody who's depressed is mentally ill, and depression is so common. You know, I don't think I know a single family who hasn't been touched by depression in some way. But it's a skeleton we keep in a closet. You know, nobody talks about it. We were certainly afraid to talk about it when Jeff got ill for the stigma.
Right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about comets, the skies, science, and the science of our brains and depression. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. Jan DeBlue is with us. She is a writer who lives on the Outer Banks, and her new book is Year of the Comets, A Journey from Sadness to the Stars. More of our conversation just ahead. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We are talking with Jan DeBlue. She is by day coastkeeper for the North Carolina Coastal Federation. She is also a writer. And by night, she watches the skies quite a bit, which she writes about in her latest book. It is called Year of the Comets, A Journey from Sadness to the Stars. This recounts her experience about a decade ago, in one year, 1996 into early 1997, when two comets came by the Earth, and it was also bracketing the beginning and what appears to be the cure of her husband's depression. We're talking about the solace that she took from stargazing. We're also taking your calls. Our number's 1-877-962-9862. Well, Jan DeBlue, you became a serious stargazer in the mid-90s, and this is the time that you suggest is that many people suggest may have been a golden age for astronomy.
Why
is that?
Oh, largely because they began to really reap a lot of benefit from the Hubble Space Telescope and some other space probes. And also, they found some really wonderful techniques. Like, they can take two telescopes and merge the light waves from them now. So the end result is, you know, as if you have a telescope of enormous size. You know, our optics have just gotten better. And because of that, you know, we can see things that we never thought we would be able to see. Mm-hmm. Some, not always in visible light, you know, sometimes with X-rays or, you know, infrared light.
Well, you have a passage in your book, Year of the Comets, where you talk about reading a newspaper article that kind of made you sit back and go, whoa. I think it was a suggestion that maybe comets could be an explanation for how life began.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? You know, the standard explanation, certainly that I grew up with, was that life was, you know, came into being because of volcanism. You know, volcanoes provided a spark that caused amino acids to kind of fuse, and that's how life was born. But now they're saying, and this is based on work that they did with the comet Hale-Bopp, now they're saying that the raw ingredients for amino acids, you know, building block of life, may have been delivered to Earth by all the comets that bombarded it shortly after Earth's formation. And I love that idea because, you know, here I was looking at these two comets that I knew were just supposed to be inanimate objects, but it was almost like they were speaking to me somehow. You know, I would go out and look at them, and, you know, they were beautiful, you know, appearing, of course, in two separate years, but it was almost as if they had appeared in Earth's skies for my benefit. I'm sure that's what ancient people have felt, you know, for millennia, but You know, it was wonderful, you know, for me as a writer to think, oh, well, maybe there is something lifelike about these comets. They help deliver the ingredients for life to Earth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A more scientific explanation, yeah, perhaps, than looking up in the stars, right, and seeing Sagittarius,
right,
as previous civilizations may have done. Well, I was wondering if you might give us another reading from
Year
of the Comet.
Sure. This is from a section, just really briefly, where, you know, it's clear that Jeff is getting better. And, you know, we have been really lucky in that, you know, Jeff was depressed during that period, and then he recovered, and he's been fine ever since, which is wonderful. And as I was writing the book, you know, I wanted to tell the story of what I saw in the skies, but it didn't seem complete without the story of, you know, the crisis that our family went through. And I began seeing all these kind of connections between the cosmos of, you know, outer space and the cosmos within the human minds. And so I tried very hard to dovetail those two parts of the book. And here's a graph that where I tried to do that. What about humans? How might they be affected by what happened in the cosmos many million light years away? The furnaces within mammoth stars were powered by fundamental particles, bits of matter governed by the same laws as those that whizzed around inside my body. I was connected to the stars by a long evolutionary chain that began with the inception of time. Some mysterious force gave birth to the stars. They in turn spawned the planet on which I stood, and on down the line to the drops of blood that coursed through my body, the neurons that fired in my brain, the neurons that misfired in Jeff's brain. We are all made of particles dancing to the same tunes. Then why do some particles misbehave, spawning cancer and mental illness?
Jan DeBlue, reading from Year of the Comets. So this was the year, as we've said, that you really got taken in by the idea of what's up there in the heavens, uh-huh, in the skies, and became a real student of astronomy, but also had to become a student of depression.
Mm, yeah.
How did your husband's depression appear? I mean, what were the appearances of it?
Well, you know, it was really hard to tell that it was a clinical depression because his mother was dying and then, you know, during the course of that year died. And, you know, I was thinking, well, yeah, he doesn't have any energy. He's really, really sad. He's not focusing very well. But it's because of his mother, right? And, you know, so when she died, you know, I expected there to be a period of mourning and then for him to begin to kind of come out of it, but he didn't. He actually got worse. And one of the things that should have been a red flag to me and wasn't was that, you know, he showed no emotion. You know, I would go up and touch his shoulder or do something. You know, we'd been married for a long time, and, you know, I was used to going and just kind of slinging my arm around him and having him kind of react and sling his arm around me, and there was none of that. You know, that should have been a sign that there was something seriously wrong. But I didn't have any real experience with depression. I don't think most people do. And so I kind of, you know, wondered, well, what's that about? And then he also had a really, really hard time focusing. And, you know, people at work and people in our family were saying, well, you know, it's just because his mother's death has really knocked him for a loop. When it didn't get better, you know, it became clear that we needed to seek some help. And he ended up going on a medical leave from his job, which turned out to be great in the sense that it gave him time to rest. A lot of times when people are depressed, they're just flat worn out. You know, they're exhausted. And what they need is rest and time to regroup.
Mm-hmm. As you said earlier, it seems like many people have had some brush with depression, mm-hmm, either having it themselves or knowing,
yeah,
somebody. And antidepressants are often part of the package.
Yeah. And, you know, finding the correct antidepressant is always, you know, is something of a challenge. There are lots out there because, you know, humans are so complex and so diverse. Hitting on the right combination is important. But, you know, Melinda, it's kind of sad in the case that, in the sense that this culture, first off, we think of ourselves as a, you know, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps type culture. So we don't have a lot of sympathy for someone who's depressed. And that's almost been made worse by the idea that antidepressants can treat this illness, you know. So you either, it's assumed that if you take an antidepressant, you should be better. And if you're not, there's really something wrong. Depression is a very complex illness, and it can be caused by, you know, any number of stresses, by, you know, a lack of rest. It can be exacerbated by your work, by family problems, what have you. And, you know, I came away from this believing firmly that, you know, these kind of mood disorders need to be treated by around, you know, a whole range of things, you know, by, you know, improvements in your life by, you know, more exercise, by more rest. And I think that that's a fallacy. You know, we depend heavily on medical cures for whatever ails us in the society.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder what the response for those around people with depression ought to be. You mentioned a moment ago pulling oneself up by the bootstraps. Or is this a very individual thing? Would some people who are depressed just need time by themselves and a spouse who goes out and looks at the skies?
Yeah, it's very individual, you know. But, you know, Jeff said something that really stuck with me. You know, once we realized how depressed he was, you know, he said, and he hid it for a long time because of the stigma that's attached to it. But once we realized what was going on, he said, you know, if I had cancer, people would be nice to me and ask how I was doing, how the treatment's going. But since I have depression, they kind of tiptoe around me and act like I'm being a jerk. And that's so sad, you know, because we're talking about a medical illness. We're not talking about something that he has chosen to do, you know, to act downtrodden. I mean, people who are depressed literally cannot help themselves.
Mm-hmm. So do they need people to approach them, or do they need time by themselves?
They need it all. You know, they probably need some counseling, or they may need some counseling. They need some medical intervention in the worst cases. You know, they may need to go on a leave of absence from work. The treatments depend absolutely on the individual. And it's hard to say. I think what they need more than anything else is just understanding and compassion. And we're not real big on doing that when we see somebody who's moping around feeling sorry for themselves.
Right. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. Jan DeBlue is with us. She is a writer from Roanoke Island. She writes normally about nature.
Yes, this is a real departure for me.
And her latest book is called The Year of the Comets, which is about nature. It's about the comets, the skies, the stars, the universe, and also about the nature of the human mind, because... The Year of the Comets refers to the two comets that appeared in 1996-1997, about the same time that her husband was suffering from depression. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. So you say your husband has recovered?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he actually has been fine for the last 8 years, which is wonderful. It's hard to believe when you're going through a depression with someone that there is, that you know, there's going to be a recovery down the road, or that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But in fact, there is. And that's one of the themes of the book. There is life after depression.
Yeah. You have a psychiatrist friend in the book here who you're quoting, saying that 80% of those who've suffered from depression are going to face a relapse.
Yeah, which is a scary
statistic. Is that a matter of waiting for the other shoe to drop? Or?
I think it's like having cancer. You're always going to be on the lookout for it. But there are things you can do to kind of, you know, to be on the offense, you know, to be preventative, you know. And one big thing is just simply, you know, doing all you can to make sure that you or whoever has been depressed, you know, your life is satisfying to you, and that you're getting time for yourself. You're not just rushing around meeting everybody else's needs. You're meeting your own needs, too, you know, through doing something fun for yourself, or taking care of yourself, or getting enough sleep, you know, so on.
Mm-hmm. What does your husband think of the book?
Yeah, many people want to know that. He's been very supportive, and has, you know, I kept saying, are you sure you want me to write this and publish it? You know, I had to think about it a long time before I published it, decided to publish it. But, you know, he's been absolutely fine with it. Interestingly enough, he was not able to read it, has not been able to read it, because he has no desire to relive those times.
Even from the distance?
Even from the distance. He asked me to have some friends read it who he trusts, and he said, you know, if it's okay with them, if they think I come across okay, then I'm fine with it.
So. Okay. Here we go to William, who joins us from Raleigh. Hi there, William.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Did you have a question for Jan DeBlue?
Yeah, well, it's more of a comment, as I've been through a serious bout of depression myself, and one of the things I found out after I've been through a treatment program is you are able to begin to detect different levels of depression in other people, but there's such a stigma associated with it that people think that they're just not feeling well and that they can deal with it themselves, when in the end, it's perfectly possible to treat it in various different forms, as you all were talking about, if they're willing to admit to depression and if somebody's willing to help them diagnose it.
Absolutely.
Do you see that, Jan DeBlue, in other people?
Yeah, I do. You know, and it's been funny since, you know, word has gotten out about the book. I've had several people come up to me and go, you know, I've been depressed, or my brother's been depressed, and I've been reluctant to seek any kind of medical help because I just keep thinking that I should be able to shake this off myself. And, you know, in some cases, I guess they can. You know, depression's like any other sickness. Sometimes you get worse cases than others. But, you know, too often medical intervention is needed and the people don't follow up on it.
Is there one symptom you see? Do you recognize some symptoms in people who may not recognize that they're depressed?
They don't focus well and they act very downtrodden. They oftentimes feel like everything that is said is an affront, you know, is directed at them, you know, and that's what happens when you're depressed. You know, you lose the ability to focus to factor out. It's almost like you lose your common sense. You know, you end up feeling like everything is directed toward you. There's no use in going on. You know, you're really angry at yourself. You're angry at other people. And it's very hard to cope with. I mean, most people don't want to be around somebody who's depressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks for the call, William. We go now to Ryan in Raleigh. Hi there, Ryan.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
All right. Thank you. I wanted to first add that this is just an amazing conversation, and it's pretty much sucked me in. I haven't got any work done.
Good. Glad to oblige.
The direct correlation between, you know, the universe and, you know, the DNA that is within us in the first place, you know, a micro universe that exists within us and a macro universe that exists around us, you know. And for one thing, my mom used to be a nurse, and she always used to say she hated full moon nights because, you know, the theory, I guess you could say, of lunacy is definitely a reality. And I was going to get your comments on that, and I've been practicing Qigong for a while. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but, you know, how the moon affects, you know, our moods in the first place.
It's a form of, it's similar to Tai Chi, right?
Yeah. Well, it's cool, you know, kind of, you know, efficient with the Tai Chi, but it's more of a standing thing and more inside of the mind. I mean, it's a lot, but Qigong is like the base of Tai Chi, so.
Okay. Janda Blue?
Lunacy and a full moon. That's one I haven't really thought about too much. You know, I know that I feel a little bit different when the moon's full just because I like to go outside and you know, stand in its light, and it's really cool to be able to look around, but... You know, I've heard, you know, any number of people say that emergency rooms are nuts on nights of full moon, and I don't have any way to explain that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We go to Kinston now. William is with us. Hi there, William.
Good afternoon.
Hey there.
I just wanted to add, with the benefit, I guess you can say, of a different perspective. I was in a private law practice for 15 years before being diagnosed with depression and getting treatment for it, and after 5 years of treatment, I wound up working representing people who have been involuntarily committed to a state hospital, and that's what I do every day, all day. My own depression didn't start to improve until I was fortunate enough to have someone I really respected to kind of hold up the mirror and say, you know that this can and must be treated to improve, and if you don't do it, then you must bear the responsibility for it. Up to that point, most patients and friends and people that I know with depression stay victims. And once they stop being victims, their chances of improving and staying well and keeping their illness managed properly go way up. It takes that turning point.
I wonder, though, about those people who think that they can tough it through, who may be depressed and think, oh, I've got to tough this through, and then don't. I wonder if there's that funky kind of line between I can do this, not seeking help, and then wallowing in it for a while and then saying, okay, I've got to tough through this again.
Yeah. I think most of the people that I know well, and I'm speaking for myself now, do exactly that. We become educated to the availability of treatment, but we're still resistant to it sometimes. There is that stigma that causes that resistance in part. But once we finally do face it and own it, then we know there's nobody else to blame. And the paradigm shift, if you will, generally makes us better able to see what we need to act on it.
Thanks for the call, William.
William, you know, actually, I hope you're still there. Something that I've noticed that's really, really interesting is that people who are depressed almost try to hide it from their therapist to some extent. I know Jeff's therapist did not realize how depressed he was until he ended up going on medical leave from his job. And as a family member, I was beginning to think, hey, there are real problems here, but I did not have access to that doctor. You know, I was not allowed to be part of that doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a real problem because when somebody gets depressed, seriously depressed, they oftentimes don't realize how badly they need treatment. But somebody from outside, you know, that doctor-patient relationship isn't allowed to tell them.
Right. I was in treatment both with and without medication at times, with and without therapy at times, for nearly 2 years when I almost killed myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it took that to have a different doctor to step up and say, okay, we're going to treat this as the serious condition that it is. And then it took a friend who happened to be a psychologist to get real down to earth with me and to face me and say, you're hiding behind this. This was a couple of years later because I was still blaming all my problems on being depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And when that individual who I really trusted had the guts to look me in the face and say, you're not accomplishing anything that you think you are, you're still hiding, that was my turning point.
Wow. Well, William, thank you. Thank you for the call. Well, Jan DeBlue, just before we go, one hears, like in William's case and in others, about it's still a science that's very unclear.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
About getting out of the black hole in the mind, rather.
Yeah.
Do we know more about the black holes in the universe than the mind?
No. Well, I don't know. We don't know much about black holes. I mean, they're still a big mystery. I think that one of the big problems with depression, and one of the reasons that we know so little about treatment, is because people are not willing to stand up and say, I'm depressed, and risk the stigma that goes along with that. And so we have all of these closet cases of depression. And that's so sad, you know. And let me just leave you with the idea that, with the thought that, you know, no matter how bad it gets, you can still find solace in nature, even in your own backyard. Look at the skies or look around.
Okay. Well, Jan DeBlue, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jan DeBlue's new book is called Year of the Comets, A Journey from Sadness to the Stars. Just ahead, remembering North Carolina's entry into the Civil War and musician Christine Kane's Notes from the Road. That's coming up in just a moment on The State of Things.